Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, drones, clones, or meteoric stones? What were the top science stories of 2013? Then, the science and politics of compassion. What brain scans and humanitarian campaigns are telling us about the human condition? 2013 was a big year for scientific research, with breakthroughs in many fields of science coupled with major new challenges confronting humanity. What were the biggest stories in science? Phil Yam joins us now. He's the managing editor of Scientific American Online. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Phil Yam. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you.
Taking a look back at 2013 in terms of first scientific advances and the stories that Scientific American has covered as the top stories, how would you compare 2013 to previous years?
One thing I've noticed in doing these lists for the past few years now, there's always seems to be one or two really major events that drive the science and drive the research and the technology. And it seemed to repeat itself again this year. In particular, I'm thinking about Typhoon Haiyan and climate change.
What you're saying is we're seeing this repetitive intense storm because we're not handling climate change.
Right. I mean, the year before was Superstorm Sandy. I mean, past years we've had major hurricanes. So in this case with Typhoon Haiyan, it was the strongest hurricane ever recorded, ever to make landfall, had wind speeds of 200 miles an hour. I mean, that's the strongest ever recorded to make landfall. Thousands of people died as a result of it, and many more were left injured and displaced. So again, it's one of those key issues that we'll just have to keep facing as we continue in the future with extreme weather events, continuing rise in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
That was the story that you called number four in your list of the top 10. Maybe what we should do is go backwards through them. Number 10 you have as brain research. What is the big story there?
The big story is it's more of an announcement. Science generally doesn't progress an event in a year that's a eureka moment. I mean, science progresses usually very incrementally. And there are very few things that you can actually say, well, this was a major breakthrough that stands by itself. Researchers stand on the shoulders of giants, if you've heard that expression. In the case of the brain research, these are really announcements for commitments to further research. So in the case of President Obama in his State of the Union address, he announced the brain research through Advancing Innovative Neurotechnologies, or the acronym BRAIN, appropriately enough. And in October, the European Commission announced something similar, also a commitment to study the brain. In their case, they want to do a computer simulation of the human brain and have that done in 10 years. So it's a really big push to really understand the brain. It's got 86 billion neurons and 100 trillion connections, and we want to know how these neurons fire and behave and how they lead to the various mental functions, why we sleep, how we form memories, or even neurologic conditions like schizophrenia and Alzheimer's disease.
I understand there's already been, in 2013, big stories with some of these. One, you just mentioned why we sleep.
It's a big mystery as why that happens. There's certain evolutionary considerations. Certain animals sleep for a very long time, like my cat sleeps forever, 18 hours a day. But some animals don't sleep very much at all, especially like a giraffe might stay up and sleep with one eye open. Dolphins sleep with, for instance, one eye open. So there are certain evolutionary differences among animals, but virtually all animals seem to sleep in some way. So it does serve some sort of purpose for the brain, and we know from research that sleep helps you retain information. It seems to also prune away all the useless information that clogs up our brains throughout the day.
They find also that lack of sleep has very deleterious effects.
You know, gets your stress hormones going if you don't sleep very much, and you can become hallucinatory after several days of non-sleep. So it's interesting because you can posit a life system that doesn't require sleep, but yet we all seem to need it. So it must have served some really, really useful purpose for it to be conserved in so many species.
The number nine story that you chose was commercial drones. We know how drones are used in war, but your article is saying they may revolutionize a lot of other areas.
Right. I think this is one of those things that's been trending over the course of several years now, first in the military arena, of course, and where it's very controversial. And now people want to use them for commercial reasons. The FAA needs to rule on this because it's another flying object in the sky, and they should have their ruling in sometime in 2015. But we picked 2013 as the year in which it really came together, where there's a lot of discussion for commercial uses. Jeff Bezos was talking about delivering packages from Amazon via drones, for instance, and that leaves all sorts of problems. And it's not just the drones falling from the sky or crashing on someone's property or on someone, but privacy issues related to that. It opens up a whole new method of surveillance that wasn't available to many other companies before. I mean, you could fly over somebody's house or property and peer in with very high-resolution cameras.
I recall reading about a hummingbird-sized drone that actually looked like a hummingbird that could be a spy drone.
Right. That's exactly the problem. We have no regulations at the moment. The technology has moved so far ahead, and we haven't really dealt with what are the consequences. So we have to struggle with this kind of privacy issues and whether or not how much can we allow this to go on.
In that particular article in your magazine, Scientific American, pertained to journalism drones, I was fascinated to read that there are already universities that are incorporating drone use. Drone Journalism Lab at the University of Nebraska and the Missouri Drone Journalism Program. Number 8 you had is gene therapy specifically for blood cancers.
Yeah, this is an interesting one. I think it was one of our major breakthroughs for gene therapy. Gene therapy took a real black eye in the late 90s when there was an accidental death from the experiments. And what happened over the course of years after a black eye and some scandal, it really seems to have recovered a lot, and it's been making really good progress, and I think the December announcement about treating blood cancers was pretty amazing. We usually think of gene therapy as a way to treat single-gene diseases like cystic fibrosis or bubble boy syndrome, for instance, where one gene is the problem and maybe you can replace that gene and the person is healthy. With the blood cancers one, leukemia, researchers are able to tweak the T cells, an antibody cell, and make it target the leukemia cells. So you're talking about expanding the use of gene therapy beyond single gene diseases. And in this case, with the blood cancers, it was quite amazing. About, they estimate maybe 2/3 of patients treated could see some positive effects. 12 of 15 patients saw complete or partial remissions over time. I mean, that's pretty astounding. The numbers are very, very small, and it's very preliminary, but it's quite amazing. And there were no serious side effects, which is might be the most important thing. We know a lot of chemo and radiotherapy often leaves patients feeling ill and sick, but these seem to have more manageable side effects.
You didn't write more generally about some of the other cancer research considered the big number one scientific breakthrough in Science magazine, which was the use of immunotherapy.
Right. It's related in the same sense that you tweak the immune system cells and make them attack the cancer, for instance. So immunotherapy has been also in the news. So this is a kind of, this gene therapy used as a kind of immunotherapy. And I think that's where there's a lot, it's much more interesting now that we have these kinds of using your body's own defenses to fight off disease. Having very targeted therapies is, I think, the key here. I mean, chemotherapy and radiation are pretty blunt instruments, and you end up destroying a lot of healthy cells as well. So anything to just only go after the cancer cells, to really go after diseased parts, it should help people and reduce side effects.
Number 7 pertained to fracking and how it has now been ascertained that this fracking also causes earthquakes.
There were so long suspicions about this, and some studies in 2013 finally confirmed that fracking and the related operations really do, in fact, cause rumblings of the ground in areas where they really shouldn't be that severe. The problem is that fracking, they inject water into deep underground to break open the rocks and pump out the oil and natural gas that's in there. What the process also leaves is a lot of wastewater, contaminated wastewater that was used, and what fossil fuel companies do is typically just pump them straight back into the ground after they've extracted all the oil and gas. Now, what's happened is that got all this wastewater they brought in and pumped through and lots of sediment, so they're pushing it all the way back down and really cramming it down in there, probably more volume than they had taken out. And what's happened is that all this water exerts a lot of pressure on the rocks underground, and it's causing earthquakes.
The process of fracking is also likely connected to the subject that we started talking about, which was Typhoon Haiyan and climate change.
Right. It's our addiction to fossil fuels, and fracking has really increased the U.S. production of oil, but at the same time, it enables us to use more oil, and that increases other problems around the world.
Well, let's go to number 6, the neutrino. What is a neutrino, and why is this an important story?
Neutrinos are these invisible particles. They can fly through you. They hardly ever interact with anything else, and you can't see them, but we know that they're there based on other kinds of experiments. Basically, they have momentum, and we can detect their momentum, and occasionally they do interact with detectors. So on Earth, we generally see these from the sun or from cosmic rays, when they impinge on the atmosphere, they lead to a chain reaction of other particles, and some of these particles are neutrinos. So the discovery here was in a detector in the South Pole picked up neutrinos that didn't come from the atmosphere or the sun. In fact, it seemed to be coming from deep space beyond our solar system. And this is the first time that astronomers have ever seen anything like this. And the thing is, nobody knows quite what it is or why it's there. It seems to be a transient phenomenon. Oh, at least it was a transient phenomenon, was first detected, probably a supernova. The odds are that's a supernova, not, say, a spaceship or something like that, right? But it's a mysterious particle that was detected, and it opens up a new way of studying the cosmos. So looking at light, you know, you can possibly be looking at it with particles if you can detect enough of these and start looking for them. I look forward to seeing what astronomers can actually do if they can find more of this and what more they can learn about space.
And so number five was the recovery of the oldest human DNA.
Right. And this was interesting because for a long time, scientists didn't think you can get intact DNA from anything over 100,000 years. And in this case, they recovered some DNA from a fossil femur bone, I think it was, and it was dated to 400,000 years ago. So what's interesting about this is not just that it's very old human DNA, and that's amazing in itself, but that the DNA resembled a species of humans that we did not think we interacted with at all. So in other words, they represent something more like the Denisovans when the bone looked more like that of a Neanderthal. So what does that mean? Nobody's quite sure, other than maybe our ancestors, our Neanderthals and Denisovans partied at one time. No one's quite sure. These were mitochondrial DNA and not the cellular DNA. So what would really be helpful is if we can find some DNA from the cell and not from the mitochondria. And that would tell us a little bit more about what's going on and what our ancestors were doing 400,000 years ago.
Where was this discovery?
This is in Spain.
And the people were called the Sima people.
Right, the Sima people. It was in that area. There's several areas where they found fossils there, and also in South Africa also have been revealing very interesting human DNA origins.
And we move to number four, which we talked about a bit, which was Typhoon Haiyan, connected to climate change. Maybe we should skip to number two, the issue of parts per million of carbon dioxide.
Right. This is one of those milestones, unfortunate milestones, that we seem to have passed. The density of carbon dioxide in an atmosphere has now reached 400 parts per million. It passed early in the spring. And why this is of concern is that for many climate scientists have said that if we pass 350 parts per million, that's really bad. Now it turns out we're already at 400 parts per million. What this means is basically that the climate global warming is in full force, and we can expect more of these extreme climate events to take place. So Typhoon Haiyan, unfortunately, seems to be going to be one of many more coming. Hurricanes have been gaining strength over time. I've been noticing more extreme hurricanes and storms, and that, of course, leads to things like not only hurricanes battering homes, but flooding and additional rainfall, and just these extreme wild weather makes it harder to cope, in addition to being deadly for people.
350 parts per million was what we wanted to keep our carbon dioxide below. Now that we have surpassed that, and they're saying that we are even going to go beyond that.
Right. You know, these levels haven't been seen in 2.5 million years, you know, back in the Pliocene epoch. And that's when there were forests in the Arctic. So it's not like we're going to have that right now or soon. But what it means is that we need to put the brakes on getting the CO2 out of the atmosphere. And some climate scientists suggest that we should really, instead of just slowly tapering off, cutting back in our production of CO2, that we really need to take the CO2 out of the atmosphere and sequester it. So there are various proposals to do that, but it raises the urgency to actually do something active about CO2.
I read that one of the proposals had something to do with like a fake forest.
Yeah, there are some proposals, and part of the issue is deforestation actually releases more carbon dioxide because trees absorb CO2, they grow, therefore they sequester it in their leaves and in their trunks. So you can try to create an artificial ones where you can actually like suck CO2 down and store it in some places. I mean, typically they're thinking about storing it underground, but there have been various proposals to try to do that.
storing underground. It sounds a little bit like the fracking problem.
Yeah, I mean, there's some, I've even heard proposals of storing it deep undersea where the pressures of the ocean would keep it down there, but who knows what it would do to the ecosystem down there.
We know from other scientists that the oceans are in dire trouble as well.
That's right. I mean, all the CO2 is making the waters of the world much more acidic, and it's wreaking havoc on coral reefs and other animals. So some sea creatures can adapt to it, but others probably not as well.
I understand some of the mammals are, in fact, developing neurological diseases and kind of going crazy in some parts.
I didn't hear that one, but that sounds certainly believable. When your ecology changes and shifts, I mean, there's all sorts of things. It makes it harder to, evolution has taken millions of years, and animals become adapted to their particular niches. I mean, that niche suddenly changes, and a lot of them cannot quickly adapt to it. So we're seeing a lot of the tropic area effects move northwards. We're seeing spring start earlier. We're seeing all these kinds of effects, and it's good for some creatures and not good for others.
And that might be more due to the toxics that are being dumped into the ocean as opposed to the climate change.
There's that issue, too. I mean, we have a lot of fossil fuel production is a very dirty business. It does release a lot of heavy metals into the soils, into the groundwater, where living creatures can interact with it. It's something, ideally, that I think would be best if we could wean ourselves off of it at some point.
One of my favorite stories of all time was a Scientific American story that was about how to power the entire planet with renewable fuels. I believe it was in 2009.
Yes, we actually had an interactive on our website about that, and there have been various plans. Many scientists actually think it's possible to even go totally solar at this point. You really have to redo our entire infrastructure, however. Our electricity grid is just much too archaic to really handle the kind of intermittent power that wind and solar would provide, and we need maybe some new battery technology. But many scientists are saying that it's not unreasonable to think that we should be able to have renewable energy system in a few decades.
Number three was the meteor explosion in Russia.
This is Chelyabinsk meteorite, or as we informally called it, three cheers for Russian dashboard cameras. Because it was really amazing to actually capture such a rare event. There was one back in 1908 that also fell in Russia, the Tunguska explosion. That was much larger. This one was smaller, but still caused quite a bit of damage and injured 1,500 people or so. And I think we're really, really lucky that no one actually died. It was really a wake-up call that there are objects in their space that astronomers have long predicted will hit us. And in this particular meteor, which has probably started about 3 feet wide and kind of broke up in the atmosphere, but nobody saw it coming. So it caught sky watchers and officials off guard. What it did was that it kind of raised the alarm level, and the UN actually started a warning group so that they can coordinate and share data about asteroids that might potentially impact the Earth. And, I mean, if you can spot it early enough, you might have time to try to deflect it.
Now, why do you think that nobody saw this coming, given how many astronomers and such are studying?
Right. Well, part of it, this one is rather small. I mean, this was 3 feet, so, I mean, really, you need to go to more like 100 feet where it's really, really dangerous. That would cause more like a large atomic explosion in the sky. I mean, you have to go a bit bigger. And they are actually tracking these and trying to find these. They're called near-Earth objects, or NEOs. And part of it is just not enough funding to really do a good systematic job. And I think part of what Chelyabinsk did was get people and politicians to really seriously wake up to this. I mean, this was a small meter, and thankfully it just caused some damage, but no loss of life. But we can't face threats from much bigger ones that cause atomic bomb-sized explosions. So we need to spot those for sure, find ways to deflect it if possible.
If, in fact, they did see a very large asteroid coming towards the Earth, deflecting, it seems like if it was very large, it'd be very difficult. Other than evacuation, are there other things that can be done?
Evacuation is probably really problematic because it's really hard to predict where on Earth it would land. I mean, just because the Earth is covered by water, it's most likely to hit the ocean. But this is why I think it's really important to spot these things early, because if you spot them things early, it's not like the asteroid's coming straight to Earth. It actually is in an orbit, and the orbit intersects the Earth's orbit. So frequently, if you spot it early enough, you can have years, possibly decades, before you to do something about it. And one of the simple things you can do is possibly launch a rocket near it and just have it exert gravitational force to tug on it just a very little bit over the course of several years, and that might be enough to push it off course. So it could be a very simple project like that, and it's really all it takes is time. Time and a little bit of gravity, and that we should be okay.
Finally, the number one story that Scientific American thought was the number one story was really the sequestration.
Yes. I mean, it's not science in per se, but we felt that when I was putting together the list and taking the poll among the editors here, you know, I asked, please vote on some of these ideas, and also list what you think is the most important one, and this one came up top by far. And what's interesting is because it's the downstream effects on science. It may not be science per se, but it had significant. It's going to have significant impact still, even though it's been like several months since it was lifted. But what it did was demand across-the-board cuts in science. The federal government funds like one-third of all U.S. science. So hard hit would be where the National Institutes of Health, the National Science Foundation. I mean, you're talking maybe 3 to 5% of their budgets, but you're still talking about like $1.6 billion in cuts for the NIH, another $283 million in cuts to the NSF. That means you don't have the money to continue your projects. You don't have the money to hire researchers. What's worse is that science proceeds over a course of several years. Typically, your experiments take time to set up, start, you have to analyze it, and the NIH funds projects last maybe 3 to 5 years. So now, all of a sudden, you have to cut, if you cut the funding and you have to drop everything right away, projects you've been working on for the past couple of years might come to nothing because of that. And then even if though some of the cuts were restored later that year, and there's still talk of trying to restore more of it for this year, restarting an experiment is not easy either. I mean, it's just like being interrupted when you're doing a task. You have to kind of refocus, rethink, and it takes time to gear up. So we're losing a lot of time, losing a lot of efficiencies, and many scientists were really concerned about how much this would set back U.S. innovation.
It also shows how politics affects everything.
Exactly. I mean, it's hard to divorce science from politics. I know some people want us to stick solely to the science, but it really is. Science is done by the people. I mean, it's the U.S. public that really kind of drives how we want to do science for the agencies that fund it. So it was a serious blow, and it was funny because, you know, the director of the NIH, Francis Collins, even has a YouTube video about the sequester blues. So we'll have to see what the impacts are long term. I'm hopeful that if we don't go through these kinds of things again, that it could be just a bad bump in the road and not something that could really kind of harm the country in the long term.
This is one of the kind of hidden aspects of politics from most Americans who vote for their politicians but don't really think twice about some of these details.
Exactly. And I think part of it is that many people don't quite understand how science influences. Science technology really kind of fills their life. They consider it important, but they really have to think about it is that you do research now that won't pay off for 10 or 20 years sometimes, but when the payoffs are huge. The internet was brought as a military project, actually, and started in the late 60s. Well, look what it's done for us now. So the projects might not mean much to people right now, that all the projects that might get killed or delayed, but many of them will have major impacts on our lives in the future. So it's kind of hard to think along those timelines for people, but it's one of those sad realities, I think, that when you have budget battles, and I think both parties really do think that, by and large, that science is important, that politics will get in the way.
Well, Phil Yam, Managing Editor of Scientific American Online, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure talking to you.
When we come back, the science and the politics of compassion. Stay tuned.
Thank you.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Does compassion and compassion training change our physiology and our sociology for the better? Three experts join us. James Doty is a clinical professor of neurosurgery at Stanford University and the founder and director of the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education. Paul Gilbert is the head of the Mental Health Research Unit and professor of clinical psychology at the University of Derby. His books include Compassion-Focused Therapy, Distinctive Features, and The Compassionate Mind, Coping with the Challenges of Life. Ian Wilkinson is a senior lecturer in sociology at the University of Kent. He is the author of Suffering, A Sociological Introduction and Anxiety in a Risk Society. Welcome to the three of you, and thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar's Circle. I'd like to begin with, what exactly is compassion? James Doty, let's begin with you. What's the scientific basis for compassion?
Let me just preface this by saying that sometimes when this comes up, you could get multiple answers from different people. And in fact, there was a person who said scientists actually do not agree on what the definition of compassion is. And I will tell you that in a general sense, and one that I think is agreed upon by a number of people, it is the recognition of the suffering of another with a desire to alleviate that suffering. And that's not necessarily to say that one has the ability to or is able to or in fact act. It is simply that they have a desire to alleviate that suffering. And maybe others can comment about what their own definition before I talk about the other aspects of compassion.
Paul Gilbert?
Yeah, I think what Jim's point is exactly what we would see as compassion, this sensitivity to suffering in self and others with a commitment to try and alleviate and to prevent it. In the model that we use, this has two psychologies to it. Firstly is the psychology of willingness to engage with suffering, to turn towards it, to try to understand it, as opposed to dissociating, avoiding, or, you know, turning your back on it. And the second psychology is acquiring the wisdom to be able to do something about it. So an example we give is of compassion is that, you know, if you see somebody fall into a fast-flowing river and you think, gosh, you know, I must jump in and save them. So the first psychology is the intention to engage and put yourself forward. But then mid-jump, you suddenly realize, oh, gosh, I can't swim. Unfortunately, there isn't any action behind it to actually alleviate suffering and so forth. And in the Buddhist traditions, there's that we learn to become enlightened in order to enlighten others. In other words, we spend a lot of time applying ourselves to learn how to alleviate suffering. So intentionality is important, but like with being a doctor or a surgeon, as Jim is, you then have to put in the work to learn what to do. So full compassion is this process of being orientated to suffering, to pay attention to it, to become aware of it, to try to understand it, the nature of it, the causes of it, and then to apply how to create within oneself the wisdom to know what to do. And finally, in our model, we have three, the flow of compassion. There's the compassion that you feel for other people, the compassion that you are open to from other people, so you're open to the helpfulness of others, and there's also self-compassion. So that's how we would see it in the therapy, in the therapy model that we use.
Ian Wilkinson, would you agree?
I think both the definitions offered so far are helpful, but it might also be useful to add into this that certainly in philosophy and social science, compassion is often defined in contrast to other related emotions such as pity, sympathy, empathy. And in relation to those other three, compassion tends to be identified as a stronger identification and concern for the suffering others than perhaps would be taking place in pity, sympathy, or empathy. These distinctions just work analytically. And it's important to add as well that we're actually talking about a very complex feeling, a moral feeling. And when it comes to discerning precisely what's taking place, it always invites, you know, contested definitions. It always invites moral debate. But put set simply, you know, a feeling for the suffering of others and married to a concern to alleviate their suffering, that's a very good place to start.
I think it was Paul who just said also compassion for the self. So it is perhaps not just for others. Would that be accurate?
I think that's absolutely correct. And I think a number of people would argue that, first of all, especially in Western society, we have a tendency to be hypercritical and to ourselves. And that can, and in fact does, have a very negative effect because it creates a self-image that in and of itself is negative. And then as a result, it's much more difficult to, number one, recognize the suffering of others, but also, in fact, to alleviate suffering. So self-compassion certainly is a critical component in the context of understanding one's ability to give compassion and recognize that to maximally do so, that has to be a component.
Let's talk about the physiology or the biology of what we're discovering through the sciences. James Doty, you're heading up this institute, and it seems that the researchers affiliated with your center have been using MRIs to study the impacts of, say, compassion training to become more compassionate. What is it finding?
I can give you a simple answer, and then there's a much more complicated answer. But maybe we back up just a little bit to say, what is it about compassion that, from if you look at an evolutionary construct, what is it about compassion that is so important? And if you look at the development of humans, multiple things happened to make us human, if you will. One is, of course, theory of mind, the ability to see that you have independent thoughts of others or vice versa. The other is the development of abstract thinking, and then, of course, complex language. And those components of our evolution required a significant increase in cortex size, but it also resulted in a requirement that the infant be cared for outside of the womb for up to 15, 20 years, in my case, apparently 30 years. But we have to take care of our children. And unless there was a very strong bonding mechanisms to the family or the mother or the parents, you would not care for your child because it takes significant energy to do so. So for our species to survive as humans with those components, it requires that we care for our young. And it takes a long time for them to develop the characteristics of humans. So that is, if you will, inherent within our DNA. The other aspect is, as we then evolved to the hunter-gatherer tribe, a couple other things had to happen. One is, in addition to this ability to recognize that your child is suffering and to intervene to stop that suffering, to make sure they're not hurt, to make sure they're going to survive, this then translated to these small hunter-gatherer groups. Because if you did not have the ability to gauge emotion or suffering, it would potentially put the entire group at risk. And that's why we have evolved incredible mechanisms to recognize, as an example, microfacial expressions to indicate suffering or emotion. And that's why we also have these connections to those that are within our group to alleviate their suffering, because from an evolutionary perspective, that is critically important to our survival. So then to take it, though, a little bit further along in terms of the physiology, well, we know that to survive, we also have to reproduce and we also have to eat. And, of course, what happens when those two events occur is that this is very strongly connected to pleasure centers. And, in fact, we also know that because compassion or caring for the other is such a critical component, those pathways in the brain that are associated with pleasure also increase their metabolism in the context of compassion as well. So it just shows you how critically important this behavior or component is to human survival.
Paul Gilbert, what would you add to this?
Yes, Jim knows much more about the neurophysiology than I do. The interesting thing is that mammals in particular respond to the distress calls of their young. And the ability to be sensitive to a distress call and respond to it may be one of the early precursors for compassion. The other aspect which is really interesting is the fact that in the evolution of the attachment system, which is what Jim was talking about, the parent is able to regulate the physiology of the infant such that the parent can calm the infant down. So when the infant's distressed, the infant can go to the parent or the parent goes to the infant, and through bodily contact, touching, and various other signals actually stimulates oxytocin and the parasympathetic system. Now, these, we think, are quite important in the experience of compassion from others, because that's one of the things I'm interested in, is how people respond to receiving compassion from others. And we think that that system is extremely important in the ability to receive compassion. So when we are experiencing compassion, when we're being self-compassionate, we are actually engaging in a sort of calming process. So the affiliative system and the attachment system, which gives rise to compassion, the ability to be sensitive to distress, then you get an input, a caring input from another, and then your distress settles down. We think that's a very important process for the regulation of distress, and in humans is fundamental. You know, when we're distressed, we nearly always turn to others who we think care and love us to find a source of comfort and support. So, you know, Jim says, you know, we're biologically set up to be regulated through relationships, and in particular through caring relationships. And the other important thing about caring relationships is that caring relationships give us courage. So if you think of something that's difficult to do, you've got a frightening hospital appointment to go to, or you're going through a painful divorce, if you turn to your friends, what you want your friends to do is not to encourage you to avoid the hospital appointment or don't go through the divorce, it's too painful, but what you want your friends to do is to encourage you and support you so that you can go through what is painful to you. You feel supported by them. They will encourage you to face what you need to face. So these mechanisms that Jim was talking about in terms of the way in which the caring system works are very fundamental, because if we don't have people around us who can understand our distress and respond to that distress and therefore encourage us to face things that we need to face, life would become very, very tough. And of course, the people who I work with who are depressed, that's exactly the problem that they often have, is they don't really have much caring in their environment.
Let's widen this now and take a look at culture and politics. When people respond to others, say in a humanitarian crisis, Ian Wilkinson, this is an area that you've been looking at. How does this work in terms of across the globe, humanitarian issues, images being seen from one country to another?
Well, before I begin to try and address that issue, I just want to say where I'm coming from is from the direction of sociology and social history. And so I take the view that whatever biological disposition we might have towards compassion is also subject to processes of social conditioning and cultural nurture. And from that perspective, one of the interesting things about modern humanitarianism is its relative novelty. It seems that in modern times, we have acquired a compassionate concern for distant strangers that was not present in earlier forms of human society. Now, understanding why that is the case, I think, involves us looking at lots of contributing factors. Some hold that it's related to the ways in which we are emotionally regulated in modern times. And the argument here would be that where we're more controlled in our emotional lives and are more concerned to display traits of civilized constraint, this also has a knock-on effect in making us more alarmed by the sight of the suffering of others and more concerned to alleviate that, remove it from our sight. That's one argument. Another argument is connected to the growth in our capacity to visualize the suffering of others. And it's possible to trace a history of humanitarianism and its development into organized forms of politics as growing hand in hand with the development of our technological capacity to render visible the suffering of others. But, of course, that also engenders lots of other debates about how the visibility of suffering might also erode capacity to feel for others just by the ubiquity of the imagery and its familiarity. We might have sometimes respond to this with, you know, feeling less for what we see. It becomes more mundane. So this is a very, very complicated set of phenomena that we're trying to explain here. I could go on, but I'll let others come into this because there's other things besides the two points I've mentioned which are involved in it, I think.
One of the things that I saw in your book, Ian Wilkinson, was about this idea of compassion fatigue, which is, I think, what you're talking about, whether or not people get fatigued from so much suffering in the world and wanting to escape it because it sort of hurts.
I think when it comes to understanding compassion fatigue, it's important to think about this at different levels. For example, if the very notion of compassion fatigue incorporates the assumption that there's a time and place where people are not tired by their compassion, they're not fatigued by it. And I think if you, historically speaking, I don't think we can look back to a time where there is this kind of untired, unfatigued place of compassion. Historically speaking, I think there's a more concerted, large-scale, organized attempt to care for the suffering of people taking place now than there ever has been in human history. And the very fact that we worry about compassion fatigue might actually reveal the opposite, that we're actually more compassionate than we ever have been and are worried perhaps that there isn't enough of it. But at the same time, as I hold to that view, though, I think when you're looking at the health of people who are involved in serious and difficult care work, there, it might be right to talk of a form of fatigue that enters into that, possesses them through the strenuous effort of care. And so I think in the context of nursing is just one example, then it is a valid category for understanding a kind of an experience of burnout that some people have when they're dealing every day with difficult and trying circumstances of care for suffering.
What I'd like to do is now turn to people who have compassion, people who may not develop that kind of compassion, and the training of compassion. Paul Gilbert, I'd like to turn to you because of an introduction that I read in your edited volume where you talked about compassion and cruelty. How would you help us understand compassion versus cruelty and their development?
Well, that's exactly what Ian was saying. I mean, the interesting thing about humans is that we are multiples. What I mean by that is there are many versions of us that are possible. So, for example, if I had been kidnapped as a three-day-old baby into a violent drug gang and, you know, whizzed off to some foreign country and brought up as a violent gangster, this version of me wouldn't exist. A very different version of Paul Gilbert would exist. So what Ian was saying is absolutely right. Not only is it our values that change, but we now know that the environment in which we live influences our genetic expression. So the environment in which we grow has fundamental impacts on the kind of versions we become, how our brains mature, how our genes get expressed. The environment is absolutely crucial. And if you look back in history, I'm afraid humans have shown themselves to be potentially an extremely nasty species. Certainly in England, up until about 300-400 years ago, every major city had a torture chamber. Watching people being hung, drawn, quartered was sort of public entertainment. And, you know, the Roman games. And we can go on, you know, the Holocaust and so on. So, you know, atrocities, what's going on in Syria right now. So the point is that, you know, although we have the potential to be most compassionate, we also have the potential to be extremely cruel. And not only can we be cruel to other people, but we can also be quite cruel to ourselves. So we have to understand compassion competes, as it were, with these other potential states of mind, these other potential selves, these which may well be partly socially created. So one of the points about compassion training is that compassion is certainly a potential, but in many of the traditions, you also have to cultivate it, because for some people, it's a more natural disposition, maybe because of genes or maybe because they come from loving backgrounds. But for other people, you do have to help people cultivate it. And that's where a lot of interest is now, is can you train people to cultivate states of mind that are conducive to compassion as opposed to conducive to greed or competitiveness or an interest in cruelty or watching sadistic movies or whatever it is. So recognizing that humans are multiple, there are many possible versions of us, there are many different states of mind. We can dissociate very easily. We can love our children in the morning and bomb somebody else's children in the afternoon. We're a very odd species in this regard. And therefore, the whole issue of cultivating, choosing, deciding, how should we educate our minds both personally and at a social level. Because if we don't make decisions about how we're going to educate our minds, it's quite easy for us to become quite an unpleasant individual to ourselves and to others. Finally, taking up Ian's point, we are moving towards a recognition that we are all part of the same human group. And how can we extend compassion and kindness to others as opposed to the tribalism and the hatred that's also very easy to inflame within us?
You're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the science and the politics of compassion. James Doty, this is one of the areas you're studying. Can you cultivate compassion? How do you do that? And what are the impacts?
I think all of those are important, and let me just make a couple comments. One is regarding Ian's comments. I think one of the reasons that we have much more interest in, if you will, the world stage and suffering that's going on is because we have much more access to that information. And to comment on the other aspect, which is the compassion fatigue aspect, if you see one child suffering, it's very easy to make a connection of sympathy and regard and desire to alleviate that suffering. And oftentimes, though, when you see a large number of people suffering and recognize that you have no ability to impact that, you are overwhelmed and therefore you withdraw because it's so painful and you're protecting your emotions. And certainly this concept of compassion fatigue or burnout within individuals, if you will, in the caring professions such as medicine, healthcare, even policing and some of these other areas, we are engaged in, if you will, protecting or caring for individuals in society. If you don't feel you have control or boundaries when you are seeing large numbers of people, it can become overwhelming, and essentially you sacrifice yourself trying to help these others when, of course, that doesn't work because if you're not at your best, you cannot care for people adequately. So that's certainly an issue, and it's one that's being addressed. The other aspect of compassion, which Paul alluded to, is this a more clear understanding of how environment or behavior, if you will, impacts the expression of certain genes in regard to the end effect of compassionate behavior. And also the reality that we know, looking at young people or children who've grown up without adequate attachment or bonding, if you will, nurturing or compassion, you can predict that they will have much more increased in the occurrence of disease or cancer, that the illnesses that they have will be more frequent and more severe and more prolonged, and that their longevity will be decreased. Conversely, when you look at people with good attachment, or if you will, who are compassionate, you see some very amazing physiologic effects, especially in the context of the ability, if you will, to train compassion. And what happens is that this has an effect on the autonomic nervous system in that there are two parts. One is the parasympathetic and one is the sympathetic. And the sympathetic system is that which was originated in the context of the earliest development of living beings, in the sense that it protected them from injury, and this is what we call the reptilian part of our brain. And this responds to threat. Now, it doesn't have to be threat, real threat. It just has to be the sense of threat. And when that happens, a variety of things occur. If you're an animal on the savanna or a human on the savanna in Africa thousands of years ago, and remember, our DNA has not changed significantly in 200,000 years, if you were on the savanna in Africa and saw a lion, your blood pressure would go up, you would run, your blood would be diverted from your abdomen to your muscles, your pupils would dilate, there'd be this release of epinephrine and cortisol, and you would run. And if you survived, all of those things would immediately go down to normal. And if you didn't, well, it didn't really matter. But in the context of modern society, this reptilian part of our brain, which engages this fear mechanism, for many people is always chronically engaged on a low level, and this was never meant to be how we functioned. And in fact, evolution is a very, very slow process, while modern society changes extraordinarily rapidly, and some people would even say exponentially. So we have not created mechanisms for our evolution and our ability to respond to our modern environment. But that being said, we have evidence that we, in fact, can change our brains this idea of neuroplasticity, whereby with certain practices, we can go from an engaged sympathetic nervous system to an engaged parasympathetic nervous system, or change the balance. When your parasympathetic nervous system is engaged, you relax, you feel a connection to others. The modern part of our brain in our frontal area that is responsible, if you will, for executive function, creativity, is engaged and allowed to function at its best. And what we see in this context is that the blood pressure decreases. These deleterious hormones such as epinephrine or cortisol levels are decreased, and our immune system functions better. And these are all very well documented events that occur when someone is compassion with intent. One of the things that both Paul and Ian commented on in regard to recognizing the suffering of others is that we have a tendency to be somewhat tribal, again, based on our evolution. But one of the components of compassion training is a recognition, one, of your own suffering, but more importantly, a recognition of our shared humanity. And there is evidence that when you clearly understand this idea that we are all, in fact, one, then this allows you to offer compassion beyond those who you know, or those who you're friendly with, or those in your defined group. As an example, there's research that's been done by David Destino at Northwestern that shows how if you don't identify with someone, it's hard to be compassionate. But if you make an effort to even identify a few traits that the other group, if you will, the out-group, how they're like you, it immediately starts to decrease your fear and anxiety, and you're defining those people in a negative way. And this is the power of compassion training, if you will, this ability to go beyond your defined group, which you automatically have a tendency to care for, as an example, a mother to her child, but even a parent to his relatives, but even beyond that, to your community, and in fact, the world community. And frankly, if we don't develop these capacities, the ability of our species to survive, I would suggest to you, is nil.
Ian Wilkinson, this is your bailiwick.
What James has done is he's portrayed compassion in a very rational vein in some of his comments he's just laid out. And I think he's involved in a very important work, which is trying to render the passion of compassion more rational and amenable to rational understanding. And maybe then we can proceed in a more rational way to acquire it and enact it in a progressive manner. The thought that it sort of evoked in me in hearing him speak was that there's quite a lot involved in compassion which seems to escape rationality as well. And I was thinking of the examples in history where there's been great outpourings of compassion in unprecedented levels. If you look at the end of the 18th century, say from the 1760s onwards, a lot of modern humanitarian concerns have their roots there. And when you examine the histories of these things, it's often that people acquire intense, passionate concern for the suffering of others almost as a surprise to themselves. This is documented by Voltaire, who in the early 1760s takes up the cause of religious toleration in the case of Jean Calas, but then is surprised at himself and recognizing that he wasn't disgusted or worried about the torture that was used to exact confessions by Jean Calas initially. But this suddenly awakened to this as a concern. And then alongside any issue relating to religious tolerance, he started to be worried about the injustice of the cruelty that was meted out upon him. And I think social historians of this period, time and time again, document the fact that people are often suddenly overwhelmed by and taken up in compassionate concerns, which are a great surprise to them, and then which then perhaps involve them in more concerted political actions to combat the causes, alleviate the effects of suffering. Now, to understand that, I think, requires us to think about human beings as subject to social pressures, cultural forces, which are not easy to nail down into any lab experiment. They're highly contextual. They're often about cumulative effects of ongoing processes. And I think understanding and being able to pinpoint exactly how the dynamics of all this plays itself out is extremely difficult to pin down in any discrete manner. That's not to say I'm not intrigued by and very interested to understand how compassion can be rendered more rational.
Paul Gilbert.
Sure. I mean, I think Ian hits it on the head, really. We're a species that adapts to our environments, and for good and for bad. And this is so we can have societies that are incredibly dissociated, where individuals literally dissociate from the suffering around them. So they go and watch, you know, tortures or people being hanged or guillotined or the Roman games or whatever it is. So we need to understand the way in which culture creates dissociation from suffering. What's interesting, I think, in the modern world is that after the Second World War, there was a very clear desire to create a better world. So in this country, for example, we built a national health service that was the envy of the world. And the idea was that we all pull together, we all work together. What's happened in the last 20 years, and I think Jeffrey Sachs's book, Prize of Civilization, is excellent on this, is that we have drifted back into competitive psychology, where actually it's not about other people. It's about what I can achieve for myself or what my firm can achieve for myself. It's all about competitive edge. In our schools, this is what we tell our children. It's all about you need to get a competitive edge. And that, I think, is problematic, because I think, in my view, that unless we do more of what James is doing in the schools and actually helping children think more in terms of being a member of the human species and that actually we're all in this together and how can we help each other, if we move more and more towards competitive edge, then what we'll end up is more of what we got, which is people doing very bad things on the stock market and in firms and so forth because they're focused on this high sense of individuality. So I think politically, the political question at the moment is how is compassion going to play out in terms of the dynamic between individual competitiveness and coming more to pay attention to the needs of the many. After the war, we were paying attention to the needs of the many. Now we pay attention to the wishes of the few. So these are very important questions for our society.
Thank you very much for being with us here in the Scholar Circle, for sharing your research, and for this really profound discussion.
Well, thank you so much. It was wonderful.
James Doty is a clinical professor of neurosurgery at Stanford University and the founder and director of the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education. Paul Gilbert is the head of the Mental Health Research Unit and professor of clinical psychology at the University of Derby. His books include Compassion-Focused Therapy, Distinctive Features, and The Compassionate Mind, Coping with the Challenges of Life. Ian Wilkinson is a senior lecturer in sociology at the University of Kent. He is the author of Suffering, A Sociological Introduction and Anxiety in a Risk Society. That is it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests, and extra special thanks to Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Leonardo Alanis, and Cuauhtemoc Aileman, who produced this show each week, and to Sud Dongre, our webmaster and web host. Most of all, thank you for listening, and if you missed any part of the show, you can go to scholarcircle.org or armudian.com or kpfk.org. You can also hear us on Stitcher, on iTunes. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at armudian. See you next week.